Hello, and welcome to the 2011 Sight into Sound Christmas Special, Stories Behind the Great Traditions of Christmas by Ace Collins, published by Zondervan. During this program, we'll journey from the 1700s to the 1900s and discover how our Christmas celebrations came to life. I'm Jim Seitz. It's the most wonderful time of the year, or so the famous Christmas song goes. But for many Americans, a modern Christmas does not seem to hold the spirit, the charm, and the warmth of an old-fashioned holiday. Yet before we bemoan the demise of what we think Christmas was like in the old days, a time when it wasn't the most commercialized holiday in America, we might want to re-examine what Christmas past really was. There is no doubt that today this holy time of year is our most frenetic, stressful season. It is therefore only natural that Christians lament that the real reason for the season seems to have been largely forgotten in the midst of cookie baking, decorating, and office parties. It seems that the most awesome event in human history, the coming of God to earth as a babe in a manger, has been forever obscured by Santa, shopping, and merrymaking. So is it really the most wonderful time of the year? Before we brood and protest too much over the ruin of what we think Christmas must have been like in generations long past, we might actually feel encouraged about the season we celebrate today when we consider what Christmas was really like in the days of old. Only in relatively recent times, the past 200 years, has Christmas even been celebrated by most Christians. Up until the 1800s, the day recognized as Christ's birthday was largely a pagan celebration. Those who bemoan the lack of religious zeal in modern Christmases would have been appalled at the way people in early America celebrated the day. For a majority of people who embraced Christmas throughout history, Christ wasn't a part of the day at all. In most of the world, especially in England and America, Christmas was not a time of worship, prayer, and reflection. Rather, it was a day set aside to sing bawdy songs, drink rum, and riot in the streets. In spite of the early success at outlawing Christmas in the New World, boatloads of immigrants soon overpowered the wishes of the Puritans. The anti-Christmas laws may have remained on the books, but they were soon ignored. In most American cities, the Lords of Disorder took over the streets on December 25th. The drunken parties and gang riots grew so bad that in 1828, the New York City Council met in special session to discuss the issue, and a special police force was formed just to deal with the unlawful conduct of citizens on Christmas Day. Yet even as New York put men in uniform out in the streets to protect life and property from the unruly Christmas revelers, the spirit of the season was about to change. While in England and America, Christmas had become little more than an excuse to party, in Germany the holiday had evolved into a time when family and friends gathered to share food and fellowship and to acknowledge and celebrate the birth of the Savior. In homes throughout Germany, Christmas was the second most holy day of the year, eclipsed only by Easter. This day was especially important to children. The music, the simple decorations, the homemade treats, and the evergreen trees that could be found in many homes made Christmas the most anticipated time of the year. The first Christmas was a simple time of beauty and wonder. The birth of Christ was less about celebration than it was about family. Though many today may grow tired of the commercialization of Christmas, in reality, it has opened the door for Christ to once again become the focal point of the season and for family, especially children, to be at the heart of the celebration. So today, much more than in the past, we can truly sing, "It's the most wonderful time of the year." Let's begin our special with the birth of the beauty of the Nutcracker Ballet. The Nutcracker Ballet is perhaps the most unique Christmas tradition, considering that this ballet was adapted from a morbid story written for adults, brought to the theater by a famous composer who had great reservations about the project's merit and especially about its Christmas setting, and originally staged by students and opening to bad reviews, one would think the ballet would have been doomed to obscurity, lost in the maze of other failed holiday theatrical productions. But the Nutcracker survived, somehow hanging on to life in communist Russia until finally finding a magical platform in a place that rarely embraced classical culture, Cold War-era United States. Could it have been a Christmas miracle that brought about the moment when the meshing of two enemies' cultures took the Nutcracker to the world? Or was it simply that the story was written in the universal language understood and embraced by children of all cultures, a language of fantasy, wonder, and joy? And all it needed was an international stage to bring that point home? Dating back to the 12th century, the Nutcracker, the tool, not the ballet, was a facet of every household's annual holiday celebration. Nuts were a special treat saved for the Christmas season, and nutcrackers were used to extract the fruit from its hard shell. Children would sit around the winter's fire and wait for their fathers to carefully crack open nuts. Then the head of the household would share these delicacies, making sure each child received the same amount. Today, this wouldn't seem like much of a Christmas treat for most children, but in the Middle Ages, nuts were morsels that kids looked forward to all year. Eating nuts was one of the most cherished customs of the season. When Christmas trees began to appear in Germany, nuts were often used as decorations on the evergreens. The hard-shelled fruit was tied to the limbs, where it tempted children for weeks. When the tree was finally taken down, usually on the 12th day of Christmas, fathers and mothers would bring out the Nutcracker and share the goodies with their eager offspring. So even before becoming a holiday ballet, the Nutcracker was an important element of the Christmas season. Perhaps that is why E.T.A. Hoffman chose the Nutcracker as a part of the title for his dark story of magical dreams in 1816. Hoffman's The Nutcracker and the Mouse King was not written for children. It was a bleak novel that examined humanity and relationships in symbolic ways. It was depressing and sometimes very hard to follow. To most adults and almost all children, the story had little redeeming value. It was hardly the kind of tale that typically becomes a Christmas classic. In the original version of Hoffman's story, Marie was a child who lived in a home devoid of love. The only thing in the entire house that gave her joy was a Christmas gift from her grandfather Drosselmeyer, a Nutcracker doll. When Marie played with the doll, it brought her great happiness. But after she had gone to bed on Christmas night, the doll conjured up some very strange dreams. In Marie's nightmare, hundreds of mice appeared in the room. These menacing little beasts were led by a terrible creature known as the Mouse King. This seven-headed demon demanded that the girl give him her marzipan dolls. If she didn't, the Mouse King would tear her new Nutcracker doll to pieces. The child was horrified, but before she had to make a choice, the Nutcracker magically came to life to battle the Mouse King. But the Nutcracker was easily defeated by the Mouse King. Left with no other choice, Marie prepared to fight the despicable villain as well. Hoffman did not describe the fight, but as the reader next witnessed Marie lying in a pool of blood, the outcome seemed obvious. Yet the little girl was horrified, as were readers, to learn that she hadn't received her injuries in the valiant battle against the Mouse King, but had been severely cut while breaking into the home's doll cabinet. Her family demanded that she admit her sins and sent her to her room. Alone and disheartened, an injured and weak Marie sulked until her grandfather came to her and told her the real story of the Mouse King and the Nutcracker. Hoffman's next literary turn has confused almost everyone who has ever read the story. Grandfather explained that there had been a long-standing feud between the Mouse King and the doll. It involved a beautiful princess who was cursed by the Mouse King and became incredibly ugly. The only way to reverse the curse was for a handsome man to crack the world's hardest nut with his teeth and give it to the doomed princess. Grandfather Drosselmeyer then explained that his own nephew brought the prized nut to the princess. When she ate it, she became beautiful again. But the young man grew hideously ugly. In fact, he resembled a nutcracker more than a human being. The princess was repelled by her hero's appearance. The king banished the boy from the kingdom. As the boy left, he accidentally stepped on the Mouse King's mother, thus creating a long-lasting feud between the Nutcracker and the Mouse King. Hoffman, satisfied that he had brought the two different tales together, picked up the story where Marie's dream had ended. In this final part of the original novel, the Nutcracker doll finally killed the Mouse King. The victor then swept the princess off her feet, kissed her, and took her to another land where he became a prince. Marie then somehow met her grandfather's ugly nephew and married him. Thus, the story's central character seemed doomed to escape one loveless home for a home that offered little but ugliness and despair. Hoffman probably wrote The Nutcracker and the Mouse King to present his own dark ideas about life. He seems to have believed that a majority of those who live on Earth will never realize a dream and will never escape the ugliness of their day-to-day existence. It is easy to see that in its original form, this story was a fairy tale that would hardly appeal to anyone except the most cynical of readers. Thus, it's hard to imagine Hoffman's story surviving a single printing, much less becoming a Christmas classic. And it probably would have been forgotten if the tale had not received some much-needed outside help. The book's publisher decided that the original story was simply too dark and brought in famed French author Alexandre Dumas to clean it up. Dumas eliminated a great deal of the hopelessness and depression, as well as the dismal ending, and turned the basic story into a children's fairy tale. In this form, the book sold pretty well and took another step toward its status as a Christmas tradition. In the final decade of the 19th century, the Dumas version of The Nutcracker and the Mouse King was given to the senior ballet master of the Russian Imperial Ballet. When the ballet master, Marius Petipa, read this children's story, he was convinced that it could be adapted to the stage. In 1891, he assigned one of his close friends and best writers, Pyotr Ilyich Tchaikovsky, to compose the score. Tchaikovsky was a middle-aged man who had lived a life almost as colorful as his music. The already legendary Russian composer, the son of a Russian mine inspector and a French mother, had been born on May 7, 1840. Tchaikovsky began composing in his early teens and wrote his first overture in 1862 while a student at St. Petersburg Conservatory. A decade later, he won a loyal following through a dozen different productions, the most famous of which was Swan Lake. Yet just when his career appeared to be placing him in a position of prominence with the likes of Mozart and Handel, the bottom fell out of his personal life. Trapped in an unhappy marriage, Tchaikovsky left his much younger wife and tried to commit suicide. Though he survived the attempt, many thought he would never come out of his depression, much less ever write again. It took several years, but Tchaikovsky finally pulled himself out of his dark pit and regained his status as a great composer by creating the 1812 Overture, Symphony No. 5 in E minor, and The Sleeping Beauty. In 1890, he even took his successful opera, The Queen of Spades, on a triumphant tour of the United States. Yet the Russian legend came home to find an assignment that did not intrigue or inspire him at all. Tchaikovsky was not impressed with The Nutcracker and the Mouse King. He didn't like the fact that it was set at a children's Christmas party. He wanted to change the setting and revamp much of the story. Petipa stood firm in his desire to stay true to Dumas' rewrite of the original story. He even gave the protesting Tchaikovsky an exact scenario of how he thought the presentation should be written and ordered the composer to follow it. Though hardly inspired, Tchaikovsky tried to throw himself into his work. When he finally finished the music, Lev Ivanov, Petipa's assistant, choreographed the production. History tells us that Petipa and Ivanov were excited by the Nutcracker's potential, while Tchaikovsky was less optimistic. The Nutcracker Ballet made its debut on December 17, 1892, at the Mariinsky Theater in Kirov, Russia. The original cast was almost entirely made up of ballet students. Those who came to watch on opening night were hardly impressed. A reviewer writing for the local paper summed up the production with these words: "For dancers, there is rather little in it. For art, absolutely nothing. And for the artistic fate of our ballet, one more step downward." With such bad critical reviews, the Nutcracker should have died quickly. But for reasons that even its famed composer did not understand, the common people loved the ballet. They came back to see it night after night. For the next 40 years, the Nutcracker was as much a part of Russian Christmas as snow and presents. Even after the communists took over the government, this element of the holidays was embraced and funded. Almost completely unknown outside the USSR, the Nutcracker was finally introduced in England in 1934. It was greeted with mild enthusiasm. 6 years later, with a world war raging in Europe, the ballet Russa de Monte Carlo presented a shortened version of the ballet in the United States. The ballet still didn't create many sparks. It was another 14 years before the full version finally was brought to the American stage in the midst of the Cold War. 90-year-old William Christensen was the force behind the Nutcracker's 1954 American debut. Working with ballet master George Balanchine, Christensen took the original Russian concept and rewrote it to appeal to children. Through Christensen's American eyes, the Nutcracker was transformed from a staid ballet into a children's classic. It was this elderly gentleman looking at the world with childlike vision who created the timeless images of Mother Buffoon and her seemingly endless line of children, a Christmas tree that grows into dreams, and the Sugar Plum Fairy. The Nutcracker was now so different, so captivating and filled with fantasy, that when audiences saw it for the first time, they immediately fell in love with it. Even people who didn't care for ballet waited in line for hours to get tickets to this Christmas masterpiece of joy and wonder. The American version of the Nutcracker quickly swept across the country and then around the world. Within a decade, it had established itself as a Christmas classic. Yet it became something more than that. The Nutcracker opened up the world of ballet and classical music to a new generation of children. Christmas performances of this musical masterpiece funded ballet troupes in hundreds of cities around the world. Just as Dumas had breathed new life into Hoffman's original depressing story, and Tchaikovsky had taken Dumas' version to a different level, Christensen's vision transformed the ballet into one almost everyone could enjoy, including the critics. Each year, more than 200 American ballet companies pack theaters from coast to coast with their versions of the Nutcracker. The ballet creates the same kind of results in Europe and Asia. Hundreds of other amateur versions, just as important to the Nutcracker's continuing popularity, are performed by children in towns and cities from coast to coast and border to border. Unlike Marie, whose nightmares helped create this tale, countless girls now have sweet dreams about becoming the Sugar Plum Fairy. The Nutcracker does not embrace the scriptural story of the first Christmas. It is simply classic fantasy told in childlike fashion. But in important ways, the Nutcracker accomplishes what the holidays are supposed to accomplish. It brings family and friends together to share in the wonder, joy, and magic of the season. Just like the bright-eyed expressions of 12th-century children, as their fathers cracked nuts at Christmas, the looks of wonder in children's eyes as they watch or participate in a much different holiday nutcracker prove that the spirit of Christmas can be reborn in a wide variety of ways around the world each year. And that spirit is something worth celebrating. Let's stay in the 1700s and discover the awe, beauty, and majesty of Handel's Messiah. In August 1741, George Friedrich Handel was at the end of his rope. He was 56 years old, in poor health, and near bankruptcy. The composer who had once been the top star in his field now found his name and fame all but forgotten. He was a has-been. His music was no longer played by the top orchestras in Europe. The man, looking like a hollow shell of what he had once been, hardly seemed capable of writing a simple song, much less the most powerful Christian music of all time. But in the midst of Handel's deep spiritual depression, events were set in motion that would trigger genius and bring Handel and his music into the bright beam of the spotlight forever. More important for Handel at that moment, these events would provide a way out of a miserable life that seemed to offer no hope. With the wolves at his door, Handel was a deeply troubled man. He was concerned not only about his inability to create music for a new generation, but also about his financial situation. He often confessed to friends that in his nightmares he saw himself spending his final days on earth in one of England's debtor prisons. Worries of losing everything he had, coupled with his long list of health concerns, robbed him of sleep and energy. This, in turn, sapped his creativity. Each day became a mirror of the previous one, with the desperate composer praying for inspiration but coming up with no new ideas. To escape the anguish of where his life seemed to be heading, Handel often sought comfort in remembering the past, and that past was one of the most glorious in music history. George Handel was born in Halle, Germany, on February 23, 1685. His interest in music developed even before he learned to read. Thanks largely to his mother's encouragement, he was given an education that included a great deal of vocal and instrumental instruction. Though obviously gifted, Handel flunked out of college. Yet in spite of his educational follies, the young man was determined to pursue a career in music. So he left home at 18 and moved to Hamburg. For the next 3 years, he conducted an orchestra at the local opera house and played violin in another orchestra during ballet performances. At the age of 21, influenced by the music around him, Handel wrote his first two operas. Though his operas garnered some minor critical success, Handel was unable to find a secure niche in the Hamburg music scene. Sensing that he needed to be exposed to a wider variety of music, he pulled up stakes and moved to Italy in 1706. There, the young composer would discover a musical genre that would in time make him one of the most famous men in all of Europe, and lead to the creation of the most powerful Christian musical of all time. In Italy, Handel wrote and presented two oratorios over the next 3 years. He was probably drawn to this musical form because of its popularity. These sacred pieces, written for choruses with strong soloists, were really little more than dramatic presentations that paraphrased stories from the Bible, created to provide moral lessons for the audience. Along with classical entertainment, oratorios closely resembled opera, minus the costumes and staging. Inexpensive to produce and easy to understand, oratorios were popular with both common people and the elite. Because they reflected his own faith and convictions, Handel loved these musical morality plays. As Handel had a flair for composition, his oratorios stood apart from a host of other Italian composers' works, and he quickly gained a following among Italy's prestigious social set. With the backing of some of the best-known members of the royal family, His fame soon grew beyond Italy, and by the age of 25, the former failed university student was a well-known composer throughout Europe. When he returned home to Germany in glory, Handel had become a hero to both his family and his friends. The German music establishment literally bowed before the young composer. The nation did not offer Handel the exposure and environment that he felt he had to have to grow. The atmosphere in his native land seemed to stifle his creative juices. He needed and wanted a freer landscape to express his creativity. At 26, Handel migrated to England. The move seemed earmarked for success when he struck gold almost as soon as he published his first piece in London. Handel's English oratorios, presented in three acts, made him one of the most popular composers in London. Yet rather than limiting himself to crafting more oratorios, Handel continued to expand his reach by writing church and secular music, instrumental pieces and operas, by creating new arrangements of past works, and by drafting exciting concertos. He even became the director of the Royal Academy of Music. For a while, he was the most famous musician in England, the Elvis of his era, and the world sought him out, honoring him time and again with position and money. It seemed the only thing that could slow him down was illness, and it would ultimately be his health that would bring him to his knees and rob him of his glory and fame. Even as a young man, Handel suffered from a wide variety of physical ailments. By the time he reached middle age, he was prone to strokes and fought long bouts with rheumatism. He was also close to blindness due to cataracts. Crude eye surgery only made the problem worse. The diseases that plagued his body also dried up his creative juices. Unable to produce additional popular works, Handel was all but destitute by August 1741. The fame that once brought the royal family to his home now could not purchase bread for his cupboard. Constantly racked by pain and partially paralyzed by another stroke, the Grand Master of Music was praying to die before he suffered a fate he considered worse than death, being carted off to a debtor's jail. What he did not know, nor could ever have guessed, was that his opportunity for personal redemption was about to present itself in the simplest manner, a rap on the door. Handel dreaded the knock of the mail carrier. His mail was rarely greetings from old friends, but rather a deluge of notes from bill collectors seeking payment. Yet on this warm day in August, the postman brought good news for a change, in the form of two letters. The first hopeful letter Handel received was an invitation to perform again in Ireland. An old friend, the Duke of Devonshire, wanted the composer to come to Dublin and produce a series of benefit concerts for the relief of the prisoners in the several gaols, and for support of Mercer's Hospital in Stephen Street and of the charitable infirmary on the Inns Quay. Handel accepted the invitation as much to escape his creditors as to direct an orchestra again. While this first letter presented Handel the opportunity to perform and to escape his miserable existence in London, it was a second correspondence from a friend that provided the inspiration that would make the Irish performances unforgettable. Charles Jennens was the kind of rich eccentric most folks avoided. He had a knack for messing up, constantly spouted foolish ideas, and always felt that his unique way of doing things was revolutionary. Most often his concepts were simply just bizarre. So a letter from Jennens would hardly be something that would excite the majority of those who knew him. But Handel, broke and out of ideas, grabbed onto the correspondence with a zeal rare for a sick man. He remembered that Jennens had once written some good lyrics. Maybe, the composer thought, The man had done it again. Jennings' letter was just what the doctor had ordered. Rather than inform Handel of a new idea or catch the composer up on the often comic routine of the eccentric's life, Jennings had sent a concept for a new oratorio. Essentially, he had reduced the Old Testament and New Testament stories of Christ to the passages he deemed the most important. It can be debated whether his efforts were genius or just a rehashing of others' work, but what cannot be doubted was the effect they had on Handel. The passages Jennings had selected revived and inspired Handel. He set his problems aside and in the next 24 days wrote what would become the most familiar oratorio of all time. It would also become one of the world's most beloved spiritual pieces and a Christmas tradition unlike any other. It was on August 22nd that Handel locked himself in his study and set to work. In 7 days, he created the first segment of his new oratorio, now known as the Christmas section of the Messiah. The next part, the redemption story, took 9 days to compose. Part 3, the resurrection and future reign of Christ on heaven and earth, took another week. Polishing the piece many times over the next few months, Handel grew so pleased with it that he took the oratorio with him to Dublin. On April 8, 1742, Handel began rehearsals of his newest musical work. He probably saw the oratorio not as a grand project, but as an intimate experience between the listener and the Lord. Because of this thinking, he chose to work with only a handful of singers and a small orchestra. He wanted to keep the Messiah tight and focused. On April 13th, the composer brought the work to life in front of a large audience. Because of his near blindness, he could not clearly see the appreciative crowd, but he could tell by the applause that he had finally composed another hit. The Irish tour was ultimately a huge success, and news quickly reached England that the composer had made a mighty comeback. A few months later, Handel took his newest work to the London stage. Everyone who was anyone found a way into the concert hall for the first few performances. On the second night, King George II was so moved by the Messiah's message that the monarch stood when he heard the Hallelujah chorus. When the audience saw the king standing, they followed suit. Thus, a tradition was born that called for all to rise during the performance of this song. The custom would continue throughout the rest of Handel's life and even to this day. With his vision so dimmed, the master composer could not see the awe this chorus inspired in his listeners, but he must have been able to feel it. Hallelujah! 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 Hallelujah!
Handel's annual Eastertide performances to benefit his favorite charity, the Foundling Hospital, kept the Messiah's composer out of debtor's prison and in the public eye for another 17 years. He conducted his most beloved work a final time just 8 days before his death in 1759. A portion of it was even played at his funeral, after which he was buried with honors at Westminster Abbey. Yet, as great as the response to the Messiah had been during his life, its popularity began to fade after Handel's death. Soon, people hardly ever heard even a portion of the oratorio at Easter. Amazingly, by the 1770s, the Great Messiah was viewed as an old-fashioned piece of music whose time had come and gone. In 1788, another legendary composer, Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart, took a stab at updating Handel's oratorio. In performances given in Vienna during the spring of 1789, Mozart expanded the original concept of the Messiah to include a full orchestra and more singers. He also cut the production and updated the arrangements, even changing melodies and harmonies to better fit with popular music of the time. Mozart's magic failed to make Handel's work more popular, and the new version, while not dismissed, did not become a rage in either Europe or England. It might have been forgotten altogether if not for a revival of oratorios during the English music festivals of the 1820s. Performed largely by amateur music lovers and sometimes crude in nature, it was through these music festivals that the common people were finally able to hear Handel's work. A host of Handel's pieces were performed, but of his many oratorios, the Messiah quickly became the favorite. In less than a decade, Handel's last great work became an essential part of almost every music festival in small towns and large cities. It even became common for parts of the oratorio to be taught to school children and sung in Sunday school classes. The upper class caught wind of Handel's oratorio's new fame and demanded that it be played at the major concert halls as well. In the Victorian tradition, this led to grand new productions featuring choirs of over 1,000 singers. It also led Sir George Grove, a one-time civil engineer and songwriter whose talents as the latter would lead to his being named director of the Royal College of Music, to restore the oratorio to its original form. He cut out Mozart's changes and directed the piece just as Handel had. In its original form, the oratorio became an Easter favorite of young and old, rich and poor, Protestant and Catholic. It was deemed the perfect musical presentation for the time when Christians remembered Christ's death and resurrection. By 1900, the Messiah was so closely linked to Easter that people began to expect to hear the oratorio each year. A performance of the Messiah was the surest way to fill up a church or a concert hall. In small English towns, as well as in large cities, the annual presentation of Handel's work brought out throngs of people. It had become such a tradition that many could not imagine Easter without Handel's Messiah. Yet forces were at work that would shift the oratorio's popularity to a completely different time of the year and, in a sense, change its impact as well. The Messiah's move to Christmas was based more on marketing than on anyone suddenly realizing that the Hallelujah Chorus and other parts of the oratorio would magnify the significance of the celebration of Christ's birth. The large crowds that turned out each Easter to hear the oratorio prompted marketers to rethink the timing of the annual presentation of Handel's work. Those raising money for charities knew that people's spirit of giving was far greater at Christmas than at Easter. Another knock against Easter was its very short holiday season, which lasted only 3 days. Meanwhile, by the time of World War II, Christmas had grown into a holiday that stretched for at least 3 weeks in Britain and Europe and as long as a month in the United States. Thus, to those needing to raise money for charities, the Christmas season seemed the perfect time to showcase the Messiah. Not only could Handel's masterpiece be performed for weeks instead of only a weekend, but with so many caught up in a wave of generosity, more money could be raised too. With fundraising as the driving force, the Messiah began to be performed during December as well as during the Easter weekend. It was an immediate Christmas hit. Today, Handel's most revered work remains the best-known and most-loved classical vocal piece in the world. It is now almost always thought of as a Christmas musical. Handel probably would have been shocked, but not disappointed by this change of seasons. Charles Burney, an 18th-century music historian, remarked that Handel's oratorio fed the hungry, clothed the naked, and fostered the orphan. As a presentation that has raised millions of dollars for charity, the Messiah has done all that and more. It has also dramatically raised spiritual awareness for millions of people. Respected music historian Robert Manson Myers gave a glimpse of the power of the Messiah when he wrote, "For the first time in musical history, the mighty drama of human redemption was treated as an epic poem." Yet it was more than this. The oratorio was so inspired that the Bible story comes to life for almost all who hear it performed. It does more than arouse the intellect. It takes root in the soul. Another music historian, R.A. Streatfeild, saw the Messiah as the first instance in the history of music of an attempt to view the mighty drama of human redemption from an artistic viewpoint. It might not have been the first, but none before or since has done it better. Inspired by the letter of a friend and prompted to action by mounting debts, George Handel birthed the piece of music that touches the heart and mind, bringing almost all who hear it closer to an understanding of God's grand plan, which began with the creation of the earth and was magnified beyond comprehension by the birth of a child in a manger. Handel's Messiah is the story of life and death, resurrection and redemption, pain and glory, and hope beyond all measure. In the 3 weeks that he composed his greatest work, Handel sensed that the Messiah was different from anything else he had ever written. He later told friends that when he contemplated each act, "I did think I did see all heaven before me and the great God himself." It would have taken that kind of inspiration to create a work so powerful that one small segment of the work, the Hallelujah Chorus, still brings people to their feet and leads people to the Lord. Know the incredible emotions experienced by Mary, Joseph, the shepherds, and the wise men when they first saw Jesus. But through Handel's Messiah, we can sense a bit of the awesome power and glory that illuminated the first Christmas and that continues to magnify the birth of Jesus today. You're listening to the 2011 Sight into Sound Christmas Special, Stories Behind the Great Traditions of Christmas by Ace Collins. I'm your host, Jim Seitz. Let's continue our special with the question that every child has asked his parents. Where does Santa Claus come from? Let's travel back to the 1800s and find out.
You better watch out. You better not cry, better not pout, I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town.
Many Christians have a problem with including Santa Claus in their Christmas celebrations. Some see the jolly old elf as a competitor to Jesus. Yet Santa, unlike traditions such as Christmas trees, holly, and mistletoe, is at least partially based on Christian principles and the example of Christian men. Santa's unselfish giving, loving nature, and devotion to duty are qualities that can and should be adopted by everyone who believes that Jesus is not just the reason for the season, but the path to salvation. There is nothing theological about Santa, but there is a great deal that makes him the perfect secular companion for the holy day when we stop and recognize Christ's birth. Santa Claus's roots can be traced back to St. Nicholas of Bari. The son of wealthy parents, Nicholas was born in the 4th century in the town of Patara, Lycia, now part of Turkey. Legend records that when his parents died, the young man took all his family's money and distributed it to the needy in his hometown. He then accepted the call to full-time Christian service, becoming a monk when he was only 17, and shortly thereafter, a priest. The few historical records from the time indicate that he was chosen to fill the position of Archbishop of Myra, while he was still in his early 20s. Nicholas must have been a remarkable man, wise beyond his years, and exhibiting a maturity that few gain until they are well past 40. In the role of Archbishop, Nicholas seemed to take on almost mythical heroic qualities. He was said to have saved many lives and to have been a powerful prayer warrior. Legend has it that he even had the ability to heal the sick, yet far more than his incredible spiritual powers, it was his generosity that most endeared Nicholas to those who knew him and that made him into a legend that lives on today. Because of his great wisdom and sensitivity, many groups throughout history have claimed Nicholas as their patron saint. Children, orphans, sailors, and even thieves look to this compassionate saint for guidance and protection. Entire countries, including Russia and Greece, also adopted him. Thus, he is seemingly a saint for all people and all ages. The date of Nicholas's death, December 6th, probably in the late 340s or 350s, was one of great sadness for the people of ancient Asia Minor. But he was not forgotten. On every anniversary of his passing, his life was commemorated with an annual feast. On St. Nicholas Eve, youngsters would set out food for Nicholas and straw for his donkey. The next morning, obedient children awoke to find their gifts replaced with sweets and toys. St. Nicholas Day is still observed in many countries, and on this day gifts are exchanged in honor of the spirit of faith, hope, and charity that he embodied. While many trace Santa's origins back to Nicholas, another Eastern European at least partially inspired the legend of the famed Christmas elf, the Duke of Borovoy. Born in Bohemia in 907, the Duke had probably heard of Nicholas. He was a devout Catholic who spent a part of each day in church with his head bowed in prayer. At the age of 15, when he became one of the leaders of Bohemia after his father's death, the young man put into practice the spirit of Christian charity in every facet of his rule. He felt his calling was to reflect God in all that he did. Rather than reflecting the general spirit of the Dark Ages, the young ruler's nation was built on trust, faith, and mercy. Wanting to inspire those he ruled, the Duke of Borovoy sought out the poor and meek and shared the bounty of his kingdom with them. It became a tradition that on each Christmas Eve, he and his pages left the warm castle and tramped through deep snow to distribute food and clothing to the poor. In spite of his kindness, the young leader was murdered by his twin brother at a church service in 929. His brother wanted to inherit the throne, and the only way this could happen was if he moved the young ruler out of the way. The Duke's final words reflected his short life's work: "May God forgive you." Though he died at just 22 years old, the Duke's spirit lived on. Stories and songs were written about the Duke of Borovoy. One of those songs, "Good King Wenceslas," is still sung today. So there can be little doubt that Wenceslas, like Nicholas, was part of the inspiration for Santa Claus. The legend of Wenceslas was carried in a song, but St. Nicholas's story might have faded into oblivion had it not been for the 10th-century Christian author Metaphrastes. The historian collected scores of stories about Nicholas. These tales, most of them as much legend as fact, inspired a host of people to follow in the priest's generous ways. Because of Metaphrastes' stories, Christmas all across Europe would never be the same. A character resembling St. Nicholas was soon invented in each of the continent's countries. In Germany, St. Nicholas became Weihnachtsmann, Christmas man. Unlike the modern Santa, Weihnachtsmann was not the principal hero of Christmas Day. He worked as a helper to the Christ child, and together they distributed gifts to children. In France, Père Noël took over Nicholas's job. He arrived each Christmas to bring special cakes, cookies, or candy. He always placed these gifts in children's shoes. In Russia, St. Nicholas evolved into Father Frost. He distributed toys in January when the Russian church observed Christmas Day. In England, he was Father Christmas, a thin, tall, elderly man who had a long beard and carried a large sack filled with toys. In the areas where St. Nicholas kept his identity as the bearer of gifts, a host of other characters developed as his assistants. Two of his most well-known helpers were Knecht Ruprecht and the Belznickel. Yet strangely, both were fearsome characters, brandishing rods and switches. It was their duty not only to reward good children, but also to reprove children who were naughty and couldn't recite their prayers from memory. In some places, the images of Knecht Ruprecht and St. Nicholas merged to form Ruklaus, Rough Nicholas, referring to his rugged appearance. Aschenklaus, Ash Nicholas, because he carried a sack of ashes as well as a bundle of switches, and Pelsnickel, Furry Nicholas, referring to his fur-clad appearance. In these cases, St. Nicholas was someone to be both loved and feared. In a very real sense, this represented the relationship most children had with their parents during this era. Not all of St. Nicholas's companions were frightening. In fact, the Christkind, the Christ child, was thought to accompany him in many countries. Often portrayed as a fair-haired young girl, this angelic figure was sometimes the gift-bearer, too. She had such a gentle nature that she served to assure children that God was always with them. Yet even though the gift-giving St. Nicholas and his cousins had many fans, they also had their detractors, most of whom were members of the clergy. After the Protestant Reformation in the 16th century, the veneration of Catholic saints was banned in Germany and England. But people had become accustomed to the annual visit from the gift-giving saint and didn't want to forget the purpose of the holiday. So in some countries, the orders of the church were defied, and the festivities of St. Nicholas Day were merged with Christmas celebrations. Although the gift-bearer took on new non-religious forms, the new forms always reflected the saint's generous spirit. Still, many in England wanted to ban Nicholas and everything else that mirrored Christmas because of their pagan roots. The unwholesome qualities of early Christmases in England made it very hard for St. Nick to gain a footing in the New World. From the time they landed on American soil in 1620, the Puritans made it illegal to mention St. Nicholas's name. People were also not allowed to sing carols, exchange gifts, or light candles at Christmas time. More than 150 years passed before any mention of St. Nick first appeared in some American newspapers during the Christmas season, which no doubt came about due to German or Dutch influences in the New World. Though he did not make much of an impact with children or adults, a few press reports in colonial newspapers in 1773 called him St. A. Claus and spoke of his impact in the homes of some immigrants. 30 years later, the roots of an American Christmas were established when the New York Historical Society, hearkening back to New York City's Dutch roots, recognized St. Nicholas as its patron saint. Its members also began to engage in the Dutch practice of giving gifts at Christmas. The fact that some kids were getting gifts for Christmas interested children throughout the newly formed Union. Because English-speaking children found the Dutch name for St. Nicholas, Sinterklaas, strange, they uttered it so quickly that it came out Santa Claus, and thus this name became Americanized. After several more years of mispronunciation, the name evolved into Santa Claus. In 1808, Washington Irving, the author of Tales from Sleepy Hollow, wrote about Sinterklaas in his book A History of New York. Irving described the December visitor as a rotund little man in typical Dutch costume, with knee breeches and a broad-brimmed hat, who traveled on a flying horse-drawn wagon dropping gifts down the chimneys of his favorites on the eve of St. Nicholas. The familiar phrase, laying his finger beside his nose, first appeared in Irving's story. While Irving opened the door for children's gifts to be delivered in December, it was a professor of theology who ultimately made Christmas a holiday whose light shined directly on the faces of children in the United States. In writing A Visit from St. Nicholas, now known as The Night Before Christmas, Clement Clark Moore would also establish the tradition of Santa Claus arriving not on St. Nicholas Eve, or on January 6th, the day of Epiphany, but on December 24th, Christmas Eve. Moore, who was a bishop of the Episcopal Church in New York City and a professor at General Theological Seminary, wrote poetry for pleasure. Legend has it that the inspiration for Moore's poem was a hack driver who had a long white beard and a red dish nose. Moore often shared his more whimsical works with his four children. On Christmas Eve, 1822, he recited to them a poem that would change the face of American Christmas forever. Supposedly, Moore didn't want his name attached to the poem. He believed it would hurt his status as a university educator. But a family member or a friend took the poem to the local paper the next year and had it published. Moore's poem described Santa as a jolly old elf who flew around the world in a miniature sleigh with eight tiny reindeer. Moore even identified the reindeer by the names we still know today and invented the method by which Santa returns up the chimney. Yet it was the fact that this Saint Nick visited girls and boys on Christmas Eve that would change Christmas forever. The Night Before Christmas by Clement Clark Moore. "'Twas the night before Christmas, when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care in hopes that St. Nicholas soon would be there. The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads. And Mama in her kerchief and I in my cap had just settled our brains for a long winter's nap. When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from my bed to see what was the matter. Away to the window I flew like a flash, tore open the shutters and threw up the sash. The moon, on the breast of the new-fallen snow, gave the luster of midday to objects below. When what to my wondering eyes should appear but a miniature sleigh and eight tiny reindeer, with a little old driver so lively and quick, I knew in a moment it must be St. Nick. More rapid than eagles his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name.
Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Donder and Blitzen. To the top of the porch, to the top of the wall, now dash away, dash away, dash away all!
As dry leaves that before the wild hurricane fly, when they meet with an obstacle mount to the sky. So up to the housetop the coursers they flew, with the sleigh full of toys and St. Nicholas too. And then in a twinkling I heard on the roof the prancing and pawing of each little hoof. As I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound. He was dressed all in fur from his head to his foot, and his clothes were all tarnished with ashes and soot. A bundle of toys he had flung on his back, and he looked like a peddler just opening his pack. His eyes, how they twinkled! His dimples, how merry! His cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. His droll little mouth was drawn up like a bow, and the beard on his chin was as white as the snow. The stump of a pipe he held tight in his teeth, and the smoke, it encircled his head like a wreath. He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly. He was chubby and plump, a right jolly old elf, and I laughed when I saw him in spite of myself. A wink of his eye and a twist of his head soon gave me to know I had nothing to dread. He spoke not a word, but went straight to his work and filled all the stockings, then turned with a jerk. And laying his finger aside of his nose and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose. He sprang to his sleigh, to his team gave a whistle, and away they all flew like the down of a thistle. But I heard him exclaim ere he drove out of sight,
"Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night!"
Moore's poem instantly made Santa an American Christmas institution. Yet what did the jolly old elf look like? Moore really hadn't described Santa. For all anyone knew, he could be short, tall, fat, skinny, old, or young. He could be any color, have a beard or be clean-shaven, and wear anything from buckskins to a lawyer's suit. Thus, in the 1840s, when department stores began to hire individuals to appear as Santa, the gift-giver appeared in a wide variety of costumes. It seemed that Santa had more looks than he had reindeer. In 1863, Thomas Nast, a German immigrant, began to define the look of the real Mr. Claus. Nast was the famed illustrator and caricaturist who created the donkey and elephant images that depicted the Democratic and Republican political parties. He was also on the staff of Harper's Weekly from 1860 until the late 1880s. When Nast was asked to illustrate Moore's The Night Before Christmas for a book of children's poems, he gave the world a Santa who was far less stern-looking than the ecclesiastical St. Nicholas of Europe. And while Santa was drawn as an elfin figure in red, there was something very human about him. Santa was kind, gentle, and jolly. Therefore, it was all the more ironic that Nast patterned his generous Santa after the industrial robber barons of the American ruling class. The artist did this as a social statement, an indirect ploy to get those who had profited from the American way of life to give back to the poor who had made them wealthy. Most of the industrialists failed to catch Nast's symbolic imagery, but America's wary president certainly knew how to make the image work for the cause of the North during the Civil War. Abraham Lincoln was so impressed with this new Santa that he asked Nast to draw the elf visiting with federal troops around a battlefield campfire on Christmas Eve. The president wanted children on both sides of the Mason-Dixon line to know that Santa Claus stood for the preservation of the Union. It is said that Nast's drawing had a dynamic effect on morale in the North during that long, cold, and bloody winter. For 25 years, Nast added more and more details to his drawings of Santa in each of Harper's Weekly's December issues. He enhanced the legend of Santa Claus and fleshed out the life of the man who was filling stockings from coast to coast. Nast drew Santa's workshop, created the naughty and nice list, and in 1885, sketched the home of the man in red. In that year's illustration, Nast presented two children looking at a map of the world and tracing Santa's journey from the North Pole to the United States. The following year, the American writer George P. Webster built on this bit of genius, explaining that Santa's toy factory and home were hidden in the ice and snow of the North Pole. Yet sadly, in a nation where many families were poor, Santa didn't call on everyone. The fact that so many children had never received a Christmas gift led to classroom debates on the existence of the Jolly Man with the Beard. In 1897, a little girl named Virginia O'Hanlon listened to some of her classmates who had never received gifts from Santa and began to have doubts about the reality of Santa. In a 1933 interview, she recalled the events that led to one of the most famous editorials of all time. "Quite naturally, I believed in Santa Claus, for he had never disappointed me. But when less fortunate little boys and girls said there wasn't any Santa Claus, I was filled with doubts. I asked my father, and he was a little evasive on the subject. It was a habit in our family that whenever any doubts came up as to how to pronounce a word or some question of historical fact was in doubt, he wrote to the question and answer column in the New York Sun. Father would always say, 'If you see it in the sun, it's so.' And that settled the matter. 'Well, I'm just going to write the sun and find out the real truth,' I said to Father. He said, 'Go ahead, Virginia. I'm sure the sun will give you the right answer as it always does.' The third grader wrote the sun, put the letter into an envelope, and mailed it to the editorial department. What happened next would make newspaper history. Dear Editor, I am 8 years old. Some of my little friends say there is no Santa Claus. Papa says if you see it in the sun, it's so. Please tell me the truth. Is there a Santa Claus?" Virginia O'Hanlon. Virginia's letter passed through several hands before it found its way to veteran editor Francis P. Church. The son of a Baptist minister, Church had covered the Civil War for the New York Times and had been on the staff of the New York Sun for 20 years. Like the other staff members who had been handed Virginia's letter, the editor wondered how he could answer the letter. After all, the Sun was a newspaper that proudly declared it printed nothing but the truth. As he read and reread Virginia's letter, he knew this would be his toughest assignment in his long newspaper career. A few days later, Virginia was thrilled to find her letter and the reply on the editorial page of the daily newspaper. Church had no idea that what he wrote would become the most remembered and beloved editorial ever penned. Virginia, your little friends are wrong. They have been affected by the skepticism of a skeptical age. They do not believe except they see. They think that nothing can be which is not comprehensible by their little minds. All minds, Virginia, whether they be men's or children's, are little. In this great universe of ours, man is a mere insect, an ant in his intellect as compared with the boundless world about him, as measured by the intelligence capable of grasping the whole of truth and knowledge. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. He exists as certainly as love and generosity and devotion exist, and you know that they abound and give to your life its highest beauty and joy. Alas, how dreary would be the world if there were no Santa Claus! It would be as dreary as if there were no Virginias. There would be no childlike faith then, no poetry, no romance to make tolerable this existence. We should have no enjoyment except in sense and sight. The external light with which childhood fills the world would be extinguished. Not believe in Santa Claus? You might as well not believe in fairies. You might get your papa to hire men to watch in all the chimneys on Christmas Eve to catch Santa Claus, but even if you did not see Santa Claus coming down, what would that prove? Nobody sees Santa Claus, but that is no sign that there is no Santa Claus. The most real things in the world are those that neither children nor men can see. Did you ever see fairies dancing on the lawn? Of course not, but that's no proof that they are not there. Nobody can conceive or imagine all the wonders that are unseen and unseeable in the world. You tear apart the baby's rattle and see what makes the noise inside. But there is a veil covering the unseen world which not the strongest man, nor even the united strength of all the strongest men that have ever lived, could tear apart. Only faith, poetry, love, romance can push aside that curtain and view and picture the supernal beauty and glory beyond. Is it all real? Ah, Virginia, in all this world there is nothing else real and abiding. No Santa Claus. Thank God he lives and lives forever. 1,000 years from now, Virginia, nay, 10 times 10,000 years from now, he will continue to make glad the heart of childhood. Virginia O'Hanlon went on to graduate from Hunter College and to earn a master's degree from Columbia. She taught in the New York City school system for 47 years. When she retired, the Sun was still running her letter every Christmas on its front page. Santa received his final makeover from artist Haddon Sunblom. Beginning in 1931, Sunblom's billboards, magazine ads, and in-store displays for Coca-Cola featured a portly, grandfatherly Santa with human proportions and a ruddy complexion. Sunblom's cheery Santa replaced Nast's image, which was a bit harsher and not as smoothly drawn as the Santa for the ages. Today, almost every drawing and living representation of the jolly old elf looks like the man Sunblom drew for the soft drink giant. There can be little doubt that this Santa is one of the most recognizable images in the entire world. In the years since the first publication of Moore's The Night Before Christmas, Santa Got Another Reindeer, Rudolph, who has appeared in countless other books, movies, and television programs, and who has grown into an icon that means as much to the image of Christmas as the tree, stocking, and gifts. Yet what so many have forgotten is that while the appearance of Santa Claus was invented by men, Santa's heart and spirit were inspired by the love and generosity of Christians such as St. Nicholas and Wenceslas. Each gift that the man in the red suit gives is a living testament to the men who gave because they felt called by God to reach out to the needy around them. In a very real sense, Santa is the living embodiment of the wonderful children's hymn, Jesus Loves the Little Children. Like Jesus, Santa loves them all. From the 1800s to the 1900s, let's end our program and relive our modern-day memories with the movies of Christmas.
In this modern age,
perfect,
too many people have lost sight of the true meaning of Christmas.
Mom!
Hush!
Shut up, Ralphie!
So now, in the spirit of the original, traditional American Christmas, MGM presents A Christmas Story.
Over the past 100 years, hundreds of movies have embraced Christmas. These films have employed every motion picture genre, from musicals to family dramas, from war movies to horror flicks, from comedy to fantasy. They have included classics such as It's a Wonderful Life and forgettable low-budget bombs like Santa Claus vs. the Martians.
Santa sets up a fantastic automatic toy factory on Mars. The Battle of the Toys, when Martian kids and Earth kids join Santa to battle the bad guys of Mars. For real space-age fun, you'll be out of this world when Santa Claus conquers the Martians.
Yet of the hundreds of films churned out by the show business machine, only a few have been so loved that watching them has become a holiday tradition in the United States and around the world. Surely the reason these select films have become such an important Christmas tradition for millions of people can be traced to the film's messages of hope, faith, redemption, honesty, and joy. None of the traditional holiday classics actually centers on the real story of the first Christmas. Yet while Hollywood has not chosen to make a film centering on the birth of Jesus, it has used the message of that event and the example of Christ's life in abstract ways to embrace themes that are vital to living a Christian life. In fact, the movies that have become holiday classics are really morality plays and are wonderful tools for teaching the importance of the most noble of human qualities, which are perhaps the greatest gifts to be shared during this special season. Charles Dickens' wonderful book, A Christmas Carol, has been made into films many times, with a wide variety of new names and settings. Movie historians have long argued over which version is the greatest, but there are now more than a dozen versions that ring true to the book and its lessons, and new versions will probably be made in the future. It seems that the world never tires of this classic story.
At this festive season of the year, Mr. Scrooge, it seems more than usually desirable to make some slight provision for the poor and destitute who suffer terribly at this present time. Some few of us are endeavoring to raise a fund to buy the poor of London meat and drink and means of warmth.
We choose this time because this is the time of all others when want is keenly felt and abundance rejoices.
Now, what shall I put you down for?
Nothing.
Nothing? Oh, I see. You wish to be anonymous.
I wish to be left alone, sir.
Hollywood first brought this classic to the screen in 1938. Reginald Owen played Scrooge, and the great character actor Gene Lockhart filled the role of his faithful employee. True to the original book, this American film was set in England during a Victorian Christmas and represented the Hollywood studio system at its very best. Yet many believe that the 1957 British version of A Christmas Carol was the first to fully define the story. Among the host of other wannabes that have been produced in the past 40 years, two of the most popular versions of Dickens' classic are probably the 1970 musical Scrooge, starring Albert Finney, and The Muppet Christmas Carol, starring Kermit the Frog and all his colorful friends.
Oh, Mr. Scrooge, you'll be very merry and happy this day, I have no doubt.
No doubt.
Cheers.
God bless us, everyone.
What makes each of these movies so outstanding is that they never stray from the lessons of the importance of family and giving that were the theme of Dickens' book. As the novel was important in recasting Christmas as a holiday for families, especially children, the film depictions of A Christmas Carol are important reminders that beyond all the commercialization of the modern Christmas, the gathering of family and the joy of giving should remain the heart of every celebration. No matter the setting, almost every version of A Christmas Carol embraces the story's British roots. But Miracle on 34th Street is uniquely American, the tale of a department store Santa who seems to be the real Mr. Claus and a girl from a family too cynical to believe in such nonsense. Miracle on 34th Street is a movie that fully gives itself over to faith. Beautifully written and wonderfully acted, the 1947 version of Miracle, with Edmund Gwenn, Maureen O'Hara, Natalie Wood, and Gene Lockhart, is the best Santa Claus movie ever made. This black-and-white version of the film has never been unseated or replaced by a host of color remakes because the movie truly captures the spirit of wishing for things unseen and having the faith to believe that somehow, some way, these dreams can come true. And like A Christmas Carol, this version of Miracle on 34th Street proves there is no place for cynicism at Christmas time.
And what's your name, little girl?
Susan Walker. What's yours?
Mine? Kris Kringle. I'm Santa Claus. You don't believe that, eh?
No. You see, my mother is Mrs. Walker.
Oh.
But I must say you're the best-looking Santa Claus I've ever seen.
Really?
Your beard, for instance. It doesn't have one of those things that goes over your ears.
Well, that's because it's real. Just like I'm really Santa Claus. Go ahead. Pull it.
Miracle reinforces the belief that when all negative emotions are replaced by the joy and wonder of the season, anything can happen, even miracles. One of the ironies of Miracle on 34th Street is that it was released in the summer and was not advertised as a Christmas film. The studio had no faith in Christmas or in the movie. But as crowds flocked to theaters to catch the film in the midst of the long, hot days of July, and as the picture was still playing in movie houses 6 months later during the cold holiday season's evenings, Hollywood learned its lesson. Christmas movies would work. The success of this film thus paved the way for studios to make more projects centered on holiday themes. Though not a critical success at the time of its release, White Christmas now ranks as one of the most beloved films of all time. The picture was made to capitalize on the popularity of Bing Crosby's version of Irving Berlin's classic Christmas song, White Christmas. The best-selling Christmas song of all time, this song made its debut in the 1942 hit movie Holiday Inn. Yet in that film, the song and Christmas Day were just a small part of the movie. The impact of both, however, were significant enough that a dozen years later, Hollywood opted to have Berlin score a new musical around the song and Christmas.
Say, I came out here for a job. Could you use me?
Well, I might find a spot for you in my first show. What can you do?
I sing a little and dance.
Couldn't guarantee any salary at first. Right now, I've got the ledger in an iron lung.
I don't care if you pay off an egg. Just give me a chance.
Well, let's see what you can do.
Thanks a lot.
You know, I've written special music for each holiday. This sort of gives me a chance to keep a little promise I made to myself. I said I was going to sing this song at the inn tonight.
I'm dreaming of a white
Christmas.
Just like the one.
With a storyline that brought a group of World War II veterans together to honor the general who had led them through the toughest battles of their lives, White Christmas was a box office smash and remains a favorite today. The music in this film probably drives its popularity, but the images of men paying tribute to someone who gave so much for them still tugs at the heartstrings as it teaches wonderful lessons about respect and love.
And may all your Christmases be white.
Christmas in Connecticut, released in 1945, presents the precept of how love can grow only in a climate of honesty. A love story that can be enjoyed by the whole family. In this romantic comedy, Dennis Morgan falls for Barbara Stanwyck with the help of a wide array of great character actors, including Sidney Greenstreet and S.Z. Sicall. This movie projects the holiday ideal of love and family in a unique and refreshing fashion. It is an old Hollywood screwball comedy, perhaps too innocent, sweet, and predictable for jaded viewers. But for those who really believe in the joys of love and who want to be submerged in the magical Christmas atmosphere, this film is perfect. They don't make movies like this anymore, and it's a real shame.
Don't you come near me, you sea wolf. After the way you deceived me.
I deceived you?
Yes, you're engaged.
You're married.
That has nothing to do with it.
Nor has my engagement.
I warn you, if you take another step, I'll scream.
Go ahead and scream. Scream the house down. Perhaps your husband will come to your rescue.
I haven't got a husband.
You haven't?
No.
And Felix was telling the truth.
Felix told you?
Everything.
Then you knew all the time?
Yes. I know something you don't know. I'm not engaged anymore.
You're not?
She married my shipmate.
She did?
I'm as free as a bird.
Oh, that's what you think.
As great as these first four movies are, it seems that almost everyone's favorite Christmas movie is It's a Wonderful Life. The story is well known. A man, George, who has sacrificed all of his dreams for his family and friends, suddenly loses everything. When his world comes apart during the holidays, he senses that his life has been wasted. Caught in a deep depression, George feels he has done nothing to change the world and decides to take his own life. But a bumbling angel named Clarence comes to his rescue. Clarence shows George the profound impact he's had on hundreds of people in his town and around the world.
Clarence?
Yes, George?
Where's Mary?
Oh, well, I can't...
I don't know how you know these things, but tell me, where is she? You know where she is, tell me where my wife is.
I'm not supposed to tell.
Please, Clarence, tell me where she is.
You're not going to like it, George.
Where is she?
She's an old maid. She never married.
Where's Mary? Where is she? Where is she?
She's just about to close up the library.
There must be some easier way for me to get my wings.
This movie ends with many of the people whom George has touched giving him the money to save his business. This proves to George that his life has been worthwhile, and it earns Clarence his wings.
Every time a bell rings, an angel gets his wings.
That's right. That's right. Atta boy, Clarence.
When this Capra film was released in 1946, many felt that the film's moral lessons were presented in a much too heavy-handed manner. Some believed that James Stewart's acting was over the top. Donna Reed's portrayal of the wife was too perfect, and the ending of the story was too ideal. Yet in retrospect, the critics were wrong. and the story of how It's a Wonderful Life grew to become a beloved classic is a mirror image of the moral taught in the movie. Though nominated for several Academy Awards, the film was quickly dismissed by movie patrons when it was released. At the time, movie fans were drawn to gritty, realistic dramas that rarely included fairy tale endings. It's a Wonderful Life was completely out of step with the times. Like its lead character, the film seemed doomed to make little impact on the world. But unlike George, the movie didn't seem to have a guardian angel until TV became the American family's primary entertainment focus. With the advent of television, It's a Wonderful Life received a second chance. People were trying to make sense of the Cold War and Vietnam and found a great deal of satisfaction in the message of an angel looking out for someone who was just trying to do his everyday job. More important was the film's most powerful lesson. Even the most menial life can make a powerful impact on society. Families, churches, and even some journalists draw on the precepts found in It's a Wonderful Life to show that a single life could influence the course of world events. The movie's lead character was the embodiment of the rewards earned by putting faith, sacrifice, truth, loyalty, and honor into action. Thus, while the film contained a message easy to embrace at Christmas, it was also a message that could and should be lived every day, which is probably why the film's popularity grows with each passing holiday season. The five films covered here are probably the most popular Christmas classics. Yet a host of others, including Bob Hope's The Lemon Drop Kid, Cary Grant's The Bishop's Wife, Gary Cooper's Meet John Doe, Janet Leigh's Holiday Affair, Darren McGavin's A Christmas Story, and Irene Dunne's Penny Serenade, are also films that depict life lessons that enhance the values of the Christmas season. Like It's a Wonderful Life, White Christmas, A Christmas Carol, Christmas in Connecticut, and Miracle on 34th Street, these movies bring families together, shed light on the importance of selfless giving, love, and charity, while emphasizing the joy and wonder of the season. Thus, in a media-oriented world, they are a very important part of a modern holiday celebration. With the success of all these great films, it seems strange that Hollywood has ignored the passion, power, and glory of the first Christmas. There are no great movies centering on the manger. There are no annually aired films that embrace the true Christmas story. This may well be a good thing, as Hollywood probably does a much better job of dealing with themes such as redemption and forgiveness in a symbolic fashion. Perhaps even Hollywood long ago realized that there is no way to capture the beauty and majesty of Christ's incarnation. The great screen directors have probably always known that even a multi-million dollar budget and the world's greatest actors could not bring Jesus' birth to life nearly as well as the children in Christmas pageants who annually act out the story found in the Gospels of Luke and Matthew. Hope you enjoyed the 2011 Sight into Sound Christmas special. The stories you heard were from a book titled Stories Behind the Great Traditions of Christmas by Ace Collins, published by Zondervan. Thank you for joining us and discovering the genesis of some of the celebrations of Christmas. Your producer for this year's special was Jim Martinez. I'm Jim Seitz. The 2011 Sight into Sound Christmas special is a production of Sight into Sound Radio, Houston, Texas.